We just wanted to take some time to say a massive thank you to Podcorn, who is our sponsor for this episode. Podcorn is the easiest way for brands and podcasters to connect. It simplifies every aspect of podcast sponsorships. We have had such an easy and straightforward experience with them so far. You literally just simply sign up, view a dashboard of amazing advertising opportunities, and then you can write and submit a pitch and wait for the reply from a brand that you love. It's that easy to start monetizing your own podcast with sponsorships that work for your podcast. It's totally in your control and gives you full creative freedom and transparency. It's also suitable for podcasts of all shapes and sizes, which we think is amazing because obviously we're only starting off. So join Podcorn today. Just visit podcorn.com. That is Podcorn, P-O-D-C-O-R-N. Warning, the following podcast contains descriptions that some listeners may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Any opinions expressed are all our own and do not in any way represent the opinions of Where We Work. Hello and welcome to Mad or Bad. My name's Rachel.
And I'm Neil.
And today we bring you the case of Philip Markov, the Craigslist killer. And also we're going to discuss some things about suicide.
Very, very good.
Happy times. So the accused Craigslist killer, 23-year-old Philip Markov, was a high-functioning, engaged to be married, second-year medical student at Boston University, prior to being booked for brutally murdering a 26-year-old masseuse and robbing at least one other female victim. He is believed to have possibly been a compulsive gambler, which may have partially motivated his crimes, police suggesting he had significant recent gambling debts. According to prosecutors, a search of his apartment yielded a semi-automatic handgun, yay America, matching the murder weapon hidden in a hollowed-out volume of Grey's Anatomy.
Oh.
Which is really dramatic, isn't it? Who does that? He had ammunition, he had plastic restraints like those used on the victim, duct tape, and perhaps most incriminating, the murder victim's underwear.
Oh my God.
Delightful.
Markov, the son of a well-to-do dentist, I suppose they're all quite well-to-do, aren't they, has been described by some who know him as cocky or arrogant, suggesting an underlying attitude of self-importance, grandiosity, and possible sense of entitlement.
He sounds delightful,
doesn't he? He does, doesn't he? Unlike what might typically be expected of a true antisocial personality, he has no known prior criminal history. Nor, from what we know so far, is there the prior requisite pattern of violent, cruel, destructive or deceitful behaviour beginning before age 15. If he in fact committed these crimes, he would appear to be extremely interpersonally exploitative, selfishly taking advantage of vulnerable victims to achieve his own financial and or sexual needs, with little or no conscience, empathy or respect for their feelings or families. Such an individual could hypothetically be diagnostically described as manifesting some, if not all, of the hallmarks of both antisocial and narcissistic personality disorder.
I think it's quite interesting that until he committed these crimes that we'll go on to speak about, to our knowledge, he didn't actually do anything else criminal.
Well, he didn't do anything else criminal, but of course...
Or never got caught. I mean, who knows? You don't know what he was like behind closed doors.
Yeah, absolutely. But of course, he could have met some of the traits, such as showing little empathy, you know, in his general everyday interactions with people.
And when we talk about
thoughts,
people that, you know, show a little empathy, they tend to... Well, a lot of them tend to be in kind of high-power jobs, don't they? So they go for, like, medicine, they go for, like, business, all those kind of, like, I guess, jobs where you have a lot of control, a lot of power.
And they say, don't they, or, well, I don't know who said, but I've heard it said, that, you know, you don't climb to the top of management or whatever by being a nice person, you know?
No, there is an element of... kind of screw everyone else, I need to do what I need to do for myself.
I mean, obviously we're generalising here, aren't we? But it's often said.
So, online he was known as Andy. He was a tall, blonde, handsome. I personally don't think he's handsome. He's not ugly. He's just, you know, he's a tall, blonde guy. The person who he was speaking to...
He dyed it.
I don't think so. So the person he was speaking to online on Craigslist, she came up with a name called Morgan. She had been a fairly successful model and an actress before things had kind of come to this point where, you know, her career wasn't really going anywhere. So
what's Craigslist, Rachel, if anyone doesn't know? What's the equivalent?
It's probably just you who doesn't know. It's kind of like a Gumtree, I guess, in the UK, but a lot of it is around like personal listings. So things like escorts, but obviously not
well,
in that
know
language.
About that kind of thing. You know what I mean? That's why I don't
it's
know.
It's well, Craigslist. No,
I've heard of it.
Well
but
known.
Yeah, I didn't really know the.
You know, massage services. And there's been like loads of killers who've put stuff up looking like, you know, looking for a person to let me eat their arm.
Well, there was a
shit like that, seriously, though.
So if you were selling your... I'm just looking at
you
now.
You could sell a bike
You sell your washing machine, yeah.
Oh, yeah. But okay. You could also...
It's also intermingled
hook up with
an
escort. It literally is a bit of everything. I've never used it because it literally is
I'm glad you
American
told me that
thing.
As my wife, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
I don't know if it's actually available in the UK or not. It's just not something...
I don't know. You'd kind of a long way to transport a washer or a bike, wouldn't it, I suppose? But anyway.
Yeah. So they chatted for hours on Craigslist with a strangely impersonal personal section. She told him she had a room at a nearby hotel in the Boston area. Using a newly bought, ready-to-go phone, he fine-tuned the details of their meeting. She was to give him a massage in the room... And she had an arrangement with her boss at the beauty salon where she worked.
I bet she did.
So basically the boss would check up on her and make sure that everything had gone okay and that she wasn't dead. And it had never failed up until then.
Happy ending? We don't know, do we? On the 14th of April 2009, 26-year-old Julissa Brisman, a professional masseuse, was found unconscious with multiple gunshot wounds at the Copley Marriott. She was transferred to Boston Medical Center, where she died from her injuries. Police say the confrontation between Brisman and her killer seemed to be begun as an attempted robbery and ended when Brisman fought the zip-tie restraints that bound her.
So CCTV from the hotel where Brisman was murdered showed a tall, clean-cut, young, blonde man in a black windbreaker leaving the hotel. As we would later find out, this man would be known as Philip Markoff, a young medical student who grew up in Boston. An electronic trail allegedly linked Markoff to another robbing of a second woman in the Westin Hotel in Boston. So it seems he had a bit of a thing for robbing ladies in hotels.
In Boston.
Cops say the previous attack occurred on April the 10th, 2009, when a 29-year-old woman advertising as an exotic dancer on Craigslist was attacked, bound and robbed of both her debit card and $800 in cash.
Let's just get on this Craigslist later, anyway.
Sounds delightful. Police in Rhode Island also believed Markoff tried to rob a woman at a Holiday Inn that same month. So when Markoff was arrested, police say he was carrying a driver's license belonging to another man, Andrew Miller, who had nothing to do with any of these crimes. They found Markoff's fingerprints on the certificate of ownership for the gun he had bought using Miller's license the previous year. The young medical student's fingerprints were also found on the wall of the hotel room where he had imprisoned Cynthia Melton and on the roll of duct tape recovered from the room in which Trisha Leffer was assaulted. So basically he's a fucking idiot and he left loads of evidence there. And probably was so narcissistic, thought he'd never get caught, so fuck it, I don't even need to kind of cover up the evidence.
Mentioned about the kind of grandiosity, what? Haven't we?
Because it's like he's literally going to like the most... public place you could think of where there's obviously going to be loads of CCTV camera, there's going to be people all around. I mean, fucking brains.
But it kind of fits into the narcissistic thing,
just,
doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm so clever, no one could ever.
Yeah, well, the evidence against him was overwhelming. However, Markoff maintained that he was innocent. When he was arrested on April 21st, 2009, not a single member of the young New Yorker's family was present. Within his first 24 hours in custody, shoelace marks were found on his neck and he was placed on...
Suicide watch.
Whatever that.
I know, that's like such a like funny thing that you hear. And when you work in mental health, you realise there's no such thing as suicide watch. Does that even mean? Like, no one uses that term.
No, no.
We should use it, though.
It's very great, suicide watch.
Well, I work with the police, though, and actually, they've picked up random, like, Americanized terms like this, and you see them, or you hear them saying things like this, and you just can't help but laugh, because you're like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
It's funny.
So the next day, his brother Jonathan visited him in custody, and Markov was reported to have said to him, "Forget about me, move to California. There is more coming out." During the time when Markov was carrying out his crimes, McAllister had been at home nursing a bad back for which she was receiving medical treatment.
So this is the fiancé?
Yeah, yeah. Unable to move much, she spent her days meticulously planning every aspect of a wedding. Although she'd been with Markov for nearly 5 years, the families did not know each other well, and none of the bridesmaids had even met him.
Sounds like a really good start, doesn't it?
According to those who knew her, she regarded him as a genius and had little doubt that he would pass his exams with flying colours. She'd tried to get into the same medical school as him, but she'd failed to make the grade. In a sad irony, her mother had warned her of a man who was said to be preying on young women in the Boston area.
So let's go back a little bit and just take a look at Philip kind of growing up and, what he was like and things. So Philip Markov was the son of Susan Hayes and Richard Markov. He was a dentist in Syracuse, New York. He had an older brother, John Markov. Philip graduated in 2004 from Vernon Verona Sherrill High School. Sounds very fancy. I bet you it was at private school.
Yeah.
Where he was a member of the National Honor Society, the History Club, and the Youth Court. Ooh. Oh, and the school bowling and golf team.
So
loads of extracurricular activities. But you know what? In America, I think apparently, like, that's what you need to do to get into university and stuff. It's all about, like, not just your grades, but about, like, the extra things that you do.
Fucking hell.
It's very competitive.
Is it? Oh, I'm glad I didn't live there.
I'm glad they just looked at my grades, because I don't do anything else in my life. So it appeared from his successes in high school that he was a pretty well-rounded and intelligent individual, one sure to go far in whatever career and direction in life he chose. His former English teacher and neighbour described him as, quote, a good student and just a really nice kid. Smart, wanting to succeed, nothing strange, nothing out of the ordinary.
After high school, Markov attended SUNY Albany, where he was a pre-med student and member of the Young Republicans. He graduated from SUNY Albany in 2007. He was a second-year medical student at Boston University School of Medicine at the time of the crimes and obviously was suspended. That's kind of a given, isn't it? Suspended from the school following the charges against him. Markov met Megan McAllister, a native of New Jersey, in 2005, when they were both volunteers at the Albany Medical Center Hospital emergency room. Crikey, they have volunteers in the emergency room. They were engaged to be married. They were engaged to be married with a wedding planned for August 14th, 2009. Markov and McAllister moved to the Boston area to attend medical school at Boston University. They lived at Quincy, Massachusetts, in their High Point apartment complex.
Isn't it weird that you have to do like an undergrad degree first before you can even go and do your...
I'm more interested where, the kind of like volunteering in that, which is very noble and good for them. But I didn't afford to get married and everything.
He's rich.
Oh, of course,
So there's speculation that Markov was attempting to pay off several outstanding gambling debts. However, there's really no substantial evidence to corroborate this. Markov was arraigned on murder charges on Tuesday, April 21st, 2009. Markov pleaded not guilty and stared straight ahead, refusing to meet the victim's family's furious gazes. The judge eventually delayed his trial until March 2011 after his lawyer argued that he had already been tried in the media. So police received a search warrant for his home where they found a semi-automatic weapon inside a hollowed-out copy of the medical textbook Grey's Anatomy. They also found duct tape, restraints in the apartment, all this kind of stuff. The story took yet another twist when NBC News reported that Markov also answered the Craigslist ad of a man seeking a transsexual hookup and included photos of himself. The rendezvous never actually occurred, and the man contacted Boston cops when he compared new photos of Markov to the shots on his computer.
Markov's fiancée consistently stood by him, attesting to his innocence before the trial. I can just only hope that the criminal justice system will not be overwhelmed and persuaded by what is being put forth in the media, said McAllister. My fiancé's fate should not rest in the court of public opinion, but rather in a court of law. However, McAllister left Markov later that month. One can only presume she came to her senses and she was scared away. She broke up with him a week after his arrest. She visited him again that June and told him she wouldn't see him again for a long period of time, if ever. He was taken to hospital and evaluated by a psychologist due to the several suicide attempts, and was eventually returned to his cell at Nashua Street Jail. On August the 15th, exactly 1 year and 1 day after he was due to be married, Markov was found.
Awkward. So while awaiting trial on August the 16th, 2010, Markov wrote his ex-fiancée's name, Megan, in blood on a wall as he killed himself in his jail cell.
Well, there's no need for that.
Well, it's just being dramatic, isn't it? And this was on the anniversary of what was supposed to have been his wedding day. What happens when you go around killing people? So Markov used an object shaved into a razor to slash major arteries in his ankles, legs and neck.
So he really went for it, meant to die.
Well, I mean, he was a medical student. He knew how to do it.
Yeah, to be fair.
So he wrapped his He wrapped his wounds in plastic, covered his head with a plastic bag and stuffed toilet paper down his throat so jail authorities could not resuscitate him. Then covered himself head to toe with a blanket. So basically, he kind of hid in the cell and left himself to bleed out as long as possible before being caught.
He covered them in plastics that would contain the blood to some degree,
So after several cell checks, a deputy sheriff noted that Markov's body hadn't moved. So he went in and made a health and welfare check and said, basically in quotes, they pulled the cover back and it was a bloodbath.
Bet it was.
Her name was in a prominent place in the cell.
Oh, on the
Really dramatic way to go out. So Markov reportedly had attempted to kill himself two times prior at the facility. On April 21st, 2009, as Markov was transported from Boston Police Headquarters to that Nashua Street jail, he stuffed wads of toilet paper down his pants, telling detectives, I might need this later.
Down his trousers, because Americans say pants.
Well, Irish people say pants too, Neil.
Yeah, we're in America. We're England now, so...
I don't care.
Come on.
Hours later, Markov made his first suicide attempt. He pulled leather strips out of his boat shoes, tied them together and tried to hang himself from the bars on his cell.
What's a boat shoe? Is that like a plimsoll? I think it is, like Converse something.
No. Anyone out there knows what a boat shoe is, please get in touch.
Yeah.
He was transferred to a secure medical unit and put under 24-hour suicide watch.
Again, what that actually means.
And then obviously... As time went on, Megan broke up with him, and basically he attempted to rake a serrated spoon over his wrist and kill himself again. This didn't work until the final attempt, which we already spoke
about. When he really kind of went for it.
Well, he probably just thought, okay, actually, I need to take this seriously if I'm really going to kill myself.
There were no public outpourings of grief, and Markov's funeral was held in private. His death denied... Julissa Brisman's family have the chance to confront him and hear the details of their loved one's final moments. Said Joanna Perkins, an attorney for Brisman's mother, Carmen Guzman, first he took their daughter from them, then he denied that opportunity for them. Perkins said, and I quote, many people who deal with homicide never get over it, but the criminal trial allows them to confront the suspect, hear the evidence and reach some resolution in the case, I guess in time. Close quote. If justice was denied, the media continued to feast on Markov's carcass. Markov appeared to know exactly what he was doing and appeared to understand the implications of his actions. This was a cowardly method in which Markov refused to accept any personal responsibility for the crude and chilling murders he committed. Obviously, we're saying about the cowardly method. We're not talking about suicide.
No, this is literally just this.
To do with him, we need to kind of make that clear.
You know it.
Because suicide.
What can you say? Like, literally, that was just his way of taking responsibility.
Yeah. And that's probably clear from... And that's probably clear from what we're saying, but I just wanted to say that, because in no way are we saying that suicide is cowardly.
Absolutely.
Attitudes towards suicide have changed many times in history.
Yeah, they have, actually. And I think it's... While we're kind of on this subject, we might as well kind of touch on suicide in general and how it's come about through the ages. So in general, this is going back to, oh my God, I don't even know when this is, like the year 452.
A long time ago.
When was that? So like Roman and Greek kind of.
2,000 years ago.
So in general, the pagan world, both Roman and Greek, had a relaxed attitude towards the concept of suicide. In quotes, if a slave commits suicide, no reproach shall fall upon his master. There are some precursors of Christian hostility to suicide in ancient Greek thinkers. So, for example, Pythagoras was against the act, though more on mathematical than moral grounds, believing that there was only a finite number of souls for use in the world.
Oh, so you don't give a shit about the morals of it.
But that the sudden and unexpected departure of one would upset a delicate balance. And Aristotle also condemned suicide, though for quite different reasons. He believed that it robbed the community of the services of one of its members, which, you know, maybe that's a bit more of a compassionate way of thinking.
We just wanted to take some time to say a massive thank you to Podcorn, who is our sponsor for this episode. Podcorn is the easiest way for brands and podcasters to connect. It simplifies every aspect of podcast sponsorships. We have had such an easy and straightforward experience with them so far. You literally just simply sign up, view a dashboard of amazing advertising opportunities, and then you can write and submit a pitch and wait for the reply from a brand that you love. It's that easy to start monetizing your own podcast with sponsorships that work for your podcast. It's totally in your control and gives you full creative freedom and transparency. It's also suitable for podcasts of all shapes and sizes, which we think is amazing because obviously we're only starting off. So join Podcorn today. Just visit podcorn.com. That is Podcorn, P-O-D-C-O-R-N.
Slightly. It's just kind of like, oh, he's a doctor or whatever they were called then.
We need him.
He's killed himself. We need him. There's no kind of empathy there, is there? In the late 17th and early 18th centuries, loopholes were invented to avoid the damnation that was promised by most Christian doctrine as a penalty of suicide. One famous example of someone who wished to end their life but avoid the eternity in hell was Christina...
I can pronounce this, I think. Jóhannsdóttir.
Right, is Icelandic or something
well,
like that?
Well, no. She's Swedish, but okay. Actually that is an Icelandic last name because it basically means Jóhann's daughter.
Are they all into...
Yeah.
Well, I mean, obviously, yeah, we're not suggesting all Icelandic people have, you know...
No, they have a really small gene pool. They have a really small...
They have a really small pool of genes. Yeah.
There's actually an app that like they check to see whether they like are basically screwing their cousins or not.
Yeah. And if they are, so what?
But they're a great bunch of lads. I love Icelandic people and I love Iceland and I wish to go back as soon as possible.
There's one in Matlock just down the road.
No, not that one.
Oh, sorry, you mean the country. So, she was a Swedish murderer who killed a child in Stockholm with the sole purpose of being executed. She is an example of those who seek suicide through execution by committing a murder, similar to suicide by cop.
Yeah, because don't people, like, commit crimes?
Or suicide by cop?
This is what I'm saying. Oh, don't people commit... Well, some people, if they want to die, but they don't want to, like, do it themselves, they'll commit a crime to try and get the police person to actually kill them.
Yeah. I mean, what's a suicide by cop? Is that a term?
A cop is an American term for...
No, I understand that. So, coppers, it's one over here as well, isn't it? Sorry, it's just a suicide by a cop. It's like a... by the police, yeah. By somebody else.
By the popo.
Yeah. By the 19th century, the act of suicide has shifted from being viewed as caused by sin to being caused by insanity in Europe. Although suicide remained illegal during this period, it increasingly became the target of satirical comment. People taking a piss. Yeah, it's hilarious, isn't it?
It is absolutely hilarious.
What's up with you? By 1879, English law began to distinguish between suicide and homicide. In 1882, the deceased were permitted daylight burial in England, and by the mid-20th century, suicide had become legal in much of the Western world.
Where, like, to commit suicide comes from, isn't it? Because it was illegal to commit suicide.
That's interesting, because I don't know if that varies... between state to state in America, because I do know
there
that...
There are still countries that it's illegal.
Because I do know that, as you know, one of my favourite long-term groups, Depeche Mode, well, their lead singer, and this is mid-90s I'm talking about here, he was arrested for trying to commit suicide.
Or was he arrested?
Well, that, I mean, I don't know. I've not spoken to Dave Gawne.
Or just using their powers to protect him?
Well, that's what I've read.
They're two very different things.
Well, yeah, of course.
You know, the way over here, like, we have a 136.
Hmm.
So, yeah.
So police powers are bringing someone to replace safety. Yes, yeah.
That you're not arresting somebody because you can't arrest somebody.
Well, that's what I've read.
Yeah, but people get this stuff wrong all the time, Neil.
I think it was an interview with him, though, so I don't know whether he got it wrong.
Yeah, but he's not a policeman. He doesn't understand the legislation.
Well, no. No.
Anyways, if anyone knows, let us know.
yeah. Anyone likes Depeche Mode, let us know.
There's no one out there.
Oh, there's loads. excellent band. So...
Oh, yeah, so we were speaking about suicide and committing suicide.
Yeah. We just went off on a tangent there. The most common way of speaking about suicide is to talk of its being committing suicide, or similar descriptions continue to be the norm in society. The alleged lack of clarity in English suicide terminology has been attributed to the connotations of crime, dishonour and sin that suicide may carry. Common language has been described as portraying suicide as a crime, and you know, that has been committed. For example, murder. This is despite the fact that suicide is largely no longer a crime.
So what term do you use then in your practice?
Took the life.
Wishes to take his life.
Yeah, or whatever, yeah.
Or wishes to die by suicide. That's kind
I mean, of I might put, you know, denies, de, you know, denies any thought intent of suicide.
Yeah, but that's still...
But I'm not. But I wouldn't put commit suicide. Committing.
But people use it all the time.
Yeah.
I like make such a like... an attempt not to use it because I know it's wrong.
Yeah. I do think the commit thing is like that, you know, nobody kills herself for, you know, it should not, the connotations between committing a crime and committing suicide, that shouldn't make it, of course, it's not a crime.
It's nothing ridiculous. To do with crime. So, just to go back a little bit and speak about actually what suicide is, because we've kind of just jumped into it, haven't we? But we've not really mentioned actually what is it. Suicide is the act of intentionally causing one's own death. So mental disorders, including depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, personality disorders, anxiety, substance abuse, they're all risk factors. However, people die by suicide for many, many reasons. And, you know, mental health services don't own suicide. You know, there's plenty of people out there who are suicidal.
I think sometimes in mental health services, people still sadly die by suicide or take their own life. And then then the mental health services, we've seen it in this area, haven't we? The mental health services get kind of castigated because so-and-so was discharged and then they took their own life. Well,
but, you know, actually, I think most people who I know who have killed themselves haven't had acute or chronic mental health issues.
No.
They might have been in distress, but that's very different. I mean, people can be in distress and not have mental health problems.
I mean, they say they don't, they when, you know, certain people with mental health problems, it's kind of when they're coming out of an acute episode of mental illness.
Yeah.
When they've got, you know, people have more motivation, don't they? To actually take action then. And then they reflect back on how unwell they were and they don't want to.
Yeah. A lot of the suicides that I see in my job are directly linked with drug and alcohol use.
Yeah, it's
when they're under the influence of alcohol. It's
impulsivity as well, isn't
it?
It's
so impulsive. People say and feel things that they don't normally feel, or, you know, it really escalates things, doesn't it? And then actually when they sober up, they don't feel that way really much at all, actually, if at all.
I mean, people's level of impulsivity changes from person to person, don't they? I mean, some people are just more naturally impulsive, and then that's obviously amplified when
we
all
drunk,
know if you're drunk. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I think part of
I remember once you telling me that you loved me.
Sorry.
When you were drunk.
But you know, I think going back to mental health services, we do a lot of work on distress tolerance, don't we? And kind of helping people to, I guess, just sit with the feeling.
There's a book in that room there on that.
In what room?
In that room in there.
What, our lounge?
Yes.
But it's true though, isn't it? That's what we kind of work towards, because
indeed,
the feelings do tend to...
dissipate.
Dissipate, that's the word I'm looking for. You just have to sit there, unfortunately, for a little bit, or, you know, distract yourself, or...
Well, you know, because the thing is, ultimately, to reduce risk of suicide to everyone. You know, you would literally have to put everyone in hospital, keep them in hospital forever,
yeah,
and have them on a one-to-one.
And that doesn't help people.
But that's no good, is it?
It doesn't help people tolerate just increases their emotions, does it?
Well, they're not tolerating them, are they? They're just being, they're not growing in any way. Not growing, but you know what I mean.
Just keeping them safe.
Yes, it would keep more people safe. Absolutely.
You can't hold people forever.
You can't do that. It's not.
Unfortunately, some people will inevitably take their own life. And that's sad.
It's very sad.
It's really sad, but you know, that's the human condition, isn't it? Mm. Always been that way.
Mm.
So I think this is really interesting, actually, talking about like more euthanasia and like physician-assisted suicide and all that kind of stuff. So decisions regarding end of life are encountered more frequently than before. Recently, there have been debates and disputes over physician-assisted or doctor-assisted suicide and euthanasia. The debate has become more intense following the assisted suicide bill. That's the American bill. I don't know what legislation do we have in this country. I don't think we have any legislation other than it's illegal.
Other than I think it's illegal. Please, if anyone does know, please let us know. When I was a student nurse, I remember going on this particular placement, clinical placement, and there was a chap there that used to work for Avro, who, he was a test pilot actually, and you know, he used to, you know, we flew, I don't know if he was one of the first people, but certainly when it was in testing, you know, the Avro Vulcan, you know, part of the Britain's 1950s V-bomber force. So, he'd led this life where he was very, you know, he's highly intelligent. That's not to say that if somebody pushes trolleys at Tesco, it's worth any more of a life, but you see my point. He was very sort of high functioning, really. And I remember talking to him about, I didn't want to bring the subject up, obviously. Have you thought of Dignitas? You know, I don't think Dignitas existed then. But he said, you know, if I had a way out of this,
yeah.
And he's spoken to his wife and his kids, you know, we'd all...
I could completely understand.
Absolutely, yeah. And I'm not...
So you want to take control of it and have the death that you want to have.
Yeah, and that's not, I'm not saying in any way at all that if somebody has got a life-limiting illness, such as motor neuron disease, that
they don't have a quality of life. Yeah. It just depends on the person.
Yeah, and I'm only talking about that particular person. Because
their family, isn't it?
Yeah, but that's the case I'm talking about. I'm not saying that...
And
anyone...
it is case by case.
Of course it is.
There's no other way.
You could have a half-decent quality of life and you're happy with that.
Well, because you talk about dementia, you always say, God, if I ever had, you know, a really progressive dementia, I'd want to go to Dignitas. Whereas I have a different view, and because I've worked with people with, well, we both have, but I've worked more with people with dementia, and I've seen people who have been in you know, very progressive dementia, and who have, I think, a quality of life. So I think it's possible to have a quality of life. Therefore, I wouldn't want someone to assume that I would want to die. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Well, I guess
it's just a different way of seeing
advanced directives, isn't it? You know.
Certainly, and being very specific about, you know, if I'm at this point, or if I'm in pain, or if I'm distressed, then, you know,
I think the pain aspect, I mean, that can be, you know, they can do marvellous things now, can't they, with pain management. It's the just kind of not
they
being...
can, but I've also seen people with really progressive dementia who were on palliative care, were on rakes of morphine, and they still, their pain wasn't controlled. And it was people like that...
But that shouldn't be that.
And it was people like that I'm just...
Surely that... I know we're getting off on a tangent here, but surely that should not be in this day and age now.
But what happens when you've exhausted all the opioids and their body is so used to them that you can literally give them, like, horse doses and their body doesn't respond? And you can see it in their face. You can see it. They don't need to tell you. It's obvious.
And again, just like, you know, we're not talking, as Rachel said, you know, we're both nurse people that I've got, you know.
But nurse people.
Yeah.
Nurse people.
Nursed people that have a good quality of life. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So it is just a case by case.
Yeah.
Thing.
And there's, yeah.
So a number of British people have visited Dignitas in Switzerland for assisted suicides, and this has doubled in the years between 2005 and 2006. Two high-profile cases brought the issue of doctor-assisted suicide back into public discourse. First, there was a 45-year-old multiple sclerosis sufferer, Debbie Purdy. She took her case to court in order to protect her husband from prosecution when assisting her to end her own life.
And that's the thing, isn't it? It's protecting the people that are still there.
Oh, the stress of that, I can't even imagine. And like, that's not an easy decision for anyone to make. Good God, that is so difficult. And then there was a Daniel James, a 23-year-old rugby player who had become paralysed in an accident. He ended his life in Switzerland. These cases challenged the idea that suicide necessarily arises from mental illness. Doctor-assisted suicide highlights this challenging question. You know, is intent to commit suicide, or we shouldn't even use that term, commit. Mm. So, you know, is that intent to kill, you know, yourself, evidence for a disease of the mind, or can it be rational?
I mean, even though that they have to have these eminent sort of people discuss that, I mean, me and you, two nurses, and I'm sure, you know, if people are listening to this, well, that's quite clear anyway, isn't it? Yeah, you could be mentally unwell, or you might have some physical...
Yeah, but...
Like, if I was, God forbid, touch wood...
I totally agree with you. What I'm saying is that I don't think the general population see it like that. I don't think it's... Because we work in it, we get it, and we kind of maybe almost take it that's, like, general knowledge.
But surely the general population can kind of empathise or understand about Daniel there, that you know, he's 23, he's a rugby player. Yeah. He's obviously very, you know, to be a rugby player, you've got to be...
I think when it's physical like that, it's a lot easier
to understand. That's what I'm saying, that would be... that. Surely that's easy to... Surely you would understand, generally, that it isn't just down to, oh, they've taken their own life, died by suicide because they're mentally unwell. You know, there's other reasons. It's not just
still,
the mental...
I still think there's some people out
there
that
maybe
that way.
Yeah,
I think there's a range of different ways of thinking about it, but definitely when it's a physical ailment, and it's kind of sad that actually just because it's a physical ailment it's easier to understand.
Well, again, yeah,
because there's many people out there who don't have mental illness but are, you know, just in a lot of distress or just genuinely don't like their lives
and
want to die.
Yeah,
and I mean, yeah, it's such a big kind of an ethical and moral debate, but I kind of think actually if their understanding of the finality of death, why shouldn't they be able to do that? It's their life.
I wonder if it'll ever be where, I mean, there's so many kind of, yeah, I wonder if it'll ever be, I wonder if the kind of allowed, if you like, in law. I think it's just going to open the floodgates if that, and then you could, like, you know, you could, do you know what I mean?
Well, it is allowed in law. I could kill myself.
No, I mean, sorry, I'm thinking more like assisting as well. Because if I was in such a state where, you know, we talked about kind of some kind of dementia-type illness.
Yeah.
Not just dementia, I'm just saying that, you know, if it was like that chap that I used to nurse.
Like a chronic, you know.
Yeah, motor neuron disease. I would say if I had to, you know, I would definitely, me personally, I'm just basing that on that individual person, if I was like that. But as I've said, in no way am I kind of saying
that. No, but you're saying if I was like that and if I wasn't happy to be like that anymore, or if there was a time that I knew that I wouldn't be happy to be living anymore, that I would be able to take control over that and die a peaceful death in my own home.
Yeah, you'd be able to do it. It is not illegal, as we've said, but it's the meat, it's how you would do it, isn't it?
Well, I think it would need to be a dignitas kind of a thing. I don't think it should come down to family, because I just think that's a grey area in itself.
Well, you wouldn't want to... Obviously, I'd end up with I'd end up doing time for you.
I'm not dying.
I'd do time for you.
You're motor neuron disease.
No, I haven't. We're not making fun of you.
Definitely
just...
not. Oh my God, I have nursed people with motor neuron. I nursed this lovely man, you know, back in Cork. He was he used to be a consultant and he had motor neuron. I remember he had one of those.
He was a Cork boy.
He was a Cork lad. I can't remember his name, not that I would say it anyway, but
no.
And he had like his
What, hands?
No, chair,
sorry, Rachel just moving her hands.
Chair thing. Like mobile chair.
Oh right, yeah, got it, yeah.
And I remember him because it was like my first time I'd ever really nursed anyone with motor neuron. I was really comfortable with people with dementia, but I wasn't comfortable nursing someone who physically was impaired but not mentally.
Yeah, cognitively.
And I remember him like brushing his teeth. But he was fantastic. He had his own way of doing it entirely. He kind of like made this toothbrush where it was like he'd basically fastened stuff to the end of it so he could like hold it easier.
Good for him, yeah.
And he was just getting on with things. But I mean, it was still really sad.
It is.
And it was difficult because I didn't know how much to do for him and I didn't want to do things for him when I knew he was this intelligent man who could, you know, and wanted to do things for himself, really. But And I'm sure he's probably not alive anymore, because I mean, I know it was quite fast in its progression. And it is, that's typically motor neuron disease, isn't it? It is quite fast in its progression.
Yeah. It's quite interesting, actually, when we were looking into this and we kind of, I was looking on YouTube about, you know, the kind of, he's not of our, but he's a very famous actor in the past, David Niven. Everyone will, you know, you've heard of David Niven. There's kind of several interviews, I think it was like mid-70s, where he started with the first symptoms, and you can see like over the years where you can see even just, yeah.
Awful, isn't it?
Absolutely. So the case of Dr. Chabot provides some insight into this problem. Dr. Chabot helped a 50-year-old social worker to take their own life. The case was taken to the Netherlands Supreme Court, or the Nederlander Supreme Court. The court did not question the rationality. The Dutch Society of Psychiatrists Committee, following the Chabot case, took the position that suicide should not be considered as a psychopathological phenomenon.
So basically, it shouldn't be considered as a disease of the mind.
Mm. Hmm. The extent to which someone is expressing their free will and is capable of being responsible for their actions is important to establish when deciding whether suicide is indicative of a psychopathological state of mind.
I love that word, psychopathological.
Psychopathological.
It just runs off the top.
It does, doesn't it? I'm going to inject that into my daily.
Just use it in your practice all the time.
Well, no, I'm just thinking if I go down to up to Co-op and buy a loaf of bread.
Okay, sir, you seem very psychopathological.
Yeah, I'll see if I can do that every day. The principle of autonomy, integral to a free society, requires that a person's decisions regarding their own life should be respected wherever possible. According to UK law, every adult is assumed to have capacity until proven otherwise.
That is so true. And that, again, that goes back to a lot of the stuff that I do in my work. Because I come across a lot of people who say that they want to hurt themselves or want to kill themselves.
Mm.
And, you know, the first thing that we look at is capacity and whether they, have that understanding of the finality of death and actually the consequences of, you know, what they're doing.
Mm.
And really, we like to... And it's not that we're telling people to go kill themselves, because that's not what that's about at all. Obviously, we want to help people and support them to, you know, as we've spoken about before, kind of deal with distress and help them to understand that it doesn't last forever. You know, it can pass. But, you know, it's important that we are not taking the responsibility from people, that people take responsibility for themselves, really.
And that's a hard thing. We've seen in
uncomfortable to do it. It's difficult.
We've seen in papers, haven't we, near where we live, in newspapers. Mm. There's a certain newspaper that can be quite...
We can't mention the name.
No.
But if you live around here, like, Jesus, you
They seem
know.
To have kind of an agenda with local mental health services.
But I think all of that is down to ignorance and a lack of understanding.
Might be, or it might just be a
and
paper
people,
seller.
Well,
because they know
too.
That the that some people of the general public, you know, and it sells papers, doesn't it?
It does. And people like to have someone to blame. And I get that when you've lost a loved one to suicide or to anything. I get it.
Yeah, but
it's nice to blame someone.
That newspaper has a part to play in educating the wider sort of public as well. And don't get me wrong, if there is any blame to be had, I'm absolutely all for that.
Absolutely. And you know, I think as practitioners, we're happy to put our hands up and say when, you know, if and when we've ever missed anything.
Mm.
But we also know what we're doing, and we, you know, do these assessments every day. Mm. So it's, you know, it's just one of those things, isn't it? So let's speak a little bit about rational suicide. So the right to die is a concept based on the opinion that a human being is entitled to end his or her own life or undergo voluntary euthanasia. Euthanasia? Do I say that
euthanasia.
Right?
Yeah, euthanasia. I think so. Mm.
Possession of this right is often understood that a person with a terminal illness or without the will to continue living should be allowed to end their own life using assisted suicide, or as well to decline life prolonging treatment. So, you know, you have like CPR and all that kind of stuff. But it's usually like, well, from what I've seen, it's usually more elderly people who would have like a DNAR or a DN... I don't know.
Do not resuscitate, yeah.
DNAR.
Do not attempt resuscitation.
I just think about what the A was for.
Yeah.
They're called something different now. I think they're called respect forms in our county now.
Yes.
But basically it sets out kind of a rule book of what to do and what not to do as regards when a health professional is helping somebody. So the question of whom, if anyone, should be empowered to make this decision is often central to the debate. Contemporary proponents of rational suicide or the right to die usually demand by rationality that the decision to kill oneself be both the autonomous decision of the agent, so not due to, you know, any kind of family coercion, and a best option under the circumstances, as well as other natural conditions such as the choice being stable, not an impulsive decision, not due to mental illness, achieved after due deliberation. So I think that's fairly, appropriate.
Yeah.
So there's different arguments though, kind of for and against really. So arguments for the right to die include, you know, if one had a right to live, then one must have a right to die, and that's really on their own terms, isn't it? And that death is a natural process of life, and we're all going to die at the end of the day. So why should we look to prevent it if the patient seeks to end it themselves? What we do at the end of our life should not be of any concern to others, and if euthanasia is strictly controlled, we can avoid entering a slippery slope and prevent patients from seeking alternative methods which may not be legal or may not actually result in their death. It might just result in long-term physical issues. So arguments against it include it can lead to a slippery slope. If we allow patients this right, it can expand and have dire consequences. It can give rise in pressuring those to end their lives or the lives of others. And, you know, the argument is that ethically it can be immoral in human and medical standards. Throwing away patients who are deemed no longer capable to be part of society. But again, I don't know who would even think that, but hey-ho.
You'd be surprised.
Yeah.
Or maybe not be surprised.
And another argument against it would include the decrease in palliative end-of-life care due to expectation of terminal patients to exercise their right to die.
I don't think
You can't have a good death without...
Yeah. I don't think it'll ever be in this, certainly not in our lifetimes, in this country.
I don't think in our lifetime, but I surely hope at some point it will come to this country.
I mean, if each case, obviously, which it would have to be, is examined on its own, you know, there'd have to be some kind of process, wouldn't there?
Yeah, of course. And that's, it wouldn't just that's be like,
here's some, here's some morphine, go and...
Well, no, because you will get people who are not in their right mind. And,
absolutely, yeah.
And that's when you need to weed that out. And
But the important thing is that they will be in the right mind at some stage. And that's the... Yeah. Mm. So this brings us to a suicide, which in my opinion was pretty rational.
So
this,
we're going back to...
Yeah. So this individual was not in any way a nice or a good person.
He was a piece of shit.
But in my eyes, had reason to end his own life. It was also, in my opinion, a very cowardly way of not having to take responsibility for his own actions. But it's a good illustration, I think, of suicide where the person is not mentally ill and has a rational reason for wanting to end the life.
I mean, yeah, he wasn't mentally ill. He was just trying to get out of a sticky situation. Yeah. So, top me son, and then I don't have to deal with anything.
Yeah. And like we've said before, but I do feel passionately about this, yeah. So when we say a very cowardly way of not having to take responsibility, people that do take their own life, responsibilities can be very overwhelming. But
this is a criminal.
We're talking about this.
He killed
people.
He was just taking the pill.
It's very important that that we obviously
definitely
say that.
I think we should also mention though, if anyone is affected by the issues kind of raised, that you know they should just speak to somebody. There's
definitely
obviously Samaritans that you can call if you do feel like you're wanting to hurt yourself.
Google Samaritans. You don't have to speak to them in person. You can email them. It'll take longer to get a reply, but you. They will reply. There's Sane Line, there's Rethink, there's, if you're in that much of a crisis, you can go to your local A&E department or...
speak to your GP.
As always, catch us on facebook.com/madorbad. You can catch us on Twitter. Our handle is @madorbadthepod. And also, we now have a Patreon account, so please go look us up. It is patreon.com/madorbad. You can access exclusive content. We have exclusive episodes only available to Patreon supporters. So go find us.